Hello, it's Friday, July 31st. I'm Mike Duran. On today's podcast, The Guardian uncovers evidence of possible collusion by Iraqi government officials in the kidnapping of five British men in Iraq, four of whom are believed dead.
I think the Iraqi government now, hopefully, will be under pressure to answer what happened to these five men.
Sources inside the Iraqi government say the evidence is compelling.
Only a government could carry out this level of operation. This wasn't an Al-Qaeda type of operation.
In other news, we speak to Debbie Purdy, the woman at the centre of the debate on assisted suicide.
People in Switzerland who want to use the law on assisted dying will die at home or in hospital. That's what I want in this country.
We join the repatriation of soldiers from Afghanistan as figures show British forces suffering their highest ever casualty rate. And we sit down with the Family Guy creator, Seth MacFarlane. First news update and paper review with Bill Overton.
Private organ transplants from dead donors are to be banned after an independent report that's found the public want to be more confident scarce donor organs are allocated fairly within the NHS. The investigation was prompted by newspaper stories about overseas patients paying to receive organs donated by British people. Violent demonstrations continued in Iran last night as protesters held memorials for people killed since the disputed election. Tens of thousands of Iranian protesters took to the streets of central Tehran after a day of unrest marking the memory of Nader Soltan, a 20-year-old student who was shot to death in June while protesting. Earlier in the day, baton-wielding riot police beat hundreds who came to honour Soltan and other victims at Tehran's central cemetery. Judges in the trial of Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi have decided to delay their verdict until next month. She is accused of breaching the terms of her house arrest by allowing an uninvited US man to stay at her home. EU diplomats at the trial in Rangoon said the judges want to review legal aspects of the case. Computer hacker Gary McKinnon is due to hear a final decision on his extradition case today. Authorities in the US want him to face trial there for breaking into American military computers. The 43-year-old from North London admits hacking, but denies it was malicious. He's challenging refusals by the Home Secretary and Director of Public Prosecutions to try him in the UK. McKinnon has already appealed unsuccessfully to the House of Lords and the European Court of Human Rights, and his latest judicial reviews in the High Court are likely to be his last chance. In sport, the Ashes' third test continues today at Edgbaston. The first day yesterday saw Australia close on 126 for one after only 30 overs played due to the bad weather. And now a look at the day's papers. Diane Purdy, the MS sufferer, fighting for the right to die, is on the front page of several papers. Britain's highest court ruled that relatives of people who want to commit suicide abroad must know whether or not they'll be prosecuted for helping them. The Guardian headlines Purdy's response as she came out of court: "I feel like I have my life back," as does The Times and The Independent. The Guardian also reports that British Army surgeons in Afghanistan are overwhelmed by the amount of casualties they're dealing with. Medics say a US team has had to step in with support. 57 British soldiers were wounded in action in the first 2 weeks of July, a number higher than previous monthly totals. The Express leads with house price rises as figures from Nationwide show an increase for the third month in a row. The paper asks, could this be the beginning of another house price boom? And Mallorca bombs lockdown is the front page of The Mirror, with details of British holidaymakers trapped on the island after yesterday's bomb attack. You can keep up to date with all the news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
We start today with a Guardian exclusive. The Guardian has discovered possible collusion by Iraqi government officials in the kidnapping of five British men. It's believed only one remains alive. Images of the men reached a global audience when they were paraded in front of the cameras.
My name is Peter Moore. I miss my family very much. I just want to get out of here.
I feel we have been forgotten. I miss my daughter and family very much and would like to return very soon. It seems here that time has no end.
Last month, the bodies of security guards Jason Swindlehurst and Jason Cresswell were handed over to the British Embassy in Iraq. Two other guards, Alan McMenemy and Alec McLachlan, are said to be very likely dead. Though IT specialist Peter Moore is thought to be alive, despite no one hearing from him since the kidnappings 2 years ago. The investigation also uncovered compelling evidence that a possible motive of the kidnappings was the work of the hostages, in finding billions of dollars of embezzled funds from government ministries. Maggie O'Kane, who made the film, explains how she uncovered the information.
We began to investigate what happened to the five forgotten men, as we called it, 8 months ago. And in the process of that investigation, we tried to go back to the heart of this story, which was to the Ministry of Finance itself, to find out what happened. And for the first time, we went and talked to eyewitnesses who began to reveal to us what seemed to be an extraordinary pattern of events, which suggested a scale and an organisation which couldn't have been carried out by a militia group, which had been previously suggested. We then tried to verify that by going to intelligence sources, and were lucky enough to find an intelligence operative who had people on the ground at the time that the actual kidnap took place at midday on the 29th of May 2007. And he gives us an extraordinary eyewitness account.
Let's hear from that intelligence operative now.
The cars were all marked as belonging to the Interior Ministry Police. The kidnappers took the weapons off the guards who were standing at the entrance. They were driving Toyota Land Cruisers, the sort of cars that the commandos from the Ministry of the Interior drive. There were about 20 cars in all. Each car was carrying around 5 men, so there must have been 80 to 100 men involved. It was a very well-planned operation. Only a government could carry out this level of operation. This wasn't an Al-Qaeda type of operation. They could get hold of 3 or 4 police cars, maybe, but never 20 police cars, complete with uniforms. Al-Qaeda couldn't do that. This is the sort of thing only a government could do.
Questions raised there, as you implied, about the size and the scale of the operation. You also spoke, didn't you, to the janitor and other admin staff, other witnesses. What did they have to say?
The eyewitness accounts from the janitor and people who were there at the time described how, when they came into the building, they knew exactly which room the British hostages were, and that they went straight there. There was no hesitation. They'd obviously been tipped off. The other information was that there was no attempt, despite the fact this being a government building, in any way to stop the kidnappers coming in, even though there were between 80 and 100.
In the film, you say that 4 of the hostages are now dead, but Peter Moore may still be alive. His job was a controversial one, wasn't it?
Well, his job was a very specific one. He worked for an organisation called Bearing Point, and they had been tasked with putting in what was called a financial management system. Now, the financial management system was a sort of electronic tracking system and was known as electronic government. And the point in that was to track missing funds. Now, the then investigator estimated that at the time of the kidnap, $18 billion of foreign government money and Iraqi government money had simply disappeared through the various ministries, and there had been and there are still 300 outstanding corruption cases against the ministries. So Peter Moore's job was to put in an electronic computer tracking system to find out where the money was going. The judge who investigated the missing billions, Judge Roddy, who now has got political asylum in the United States, pointed out that immediately that Peter Moore and the other 4 Britons were taken hostage, the whole electronic management system at the Ministry of Finance was suspended, even though a number of Iraqis themselves within the ministry, low-level Iraqis, had been trained to operate this system. It was simply cancelled and it was never implemented.
Maybe there are some people who don't want a very high level of corruption to be revealed. They just didn't want to be discovered. Remember, this is the Information Technology Centre. This is the place where all the money to do with Iraq and all Iraq's financial matters are housed. The centre is linked to the Americans and all the money transfers. Everything, right down to the last penny, is in that centre.
And finally then, you spoke to the Iraqi National Security Advisor, Muwaffaq al-Rubai. Let's hear your question to him.
How, people ask, could they have been taken from a government ministry? What did you think at the time?
Well, the government institutions, they're not, if you like, infallible. There are some militias infiltrating these institutions. We had a rough idea who has taken them. And where did they go?
And where did they go initially?
Well, we believe that they stayed in Baghdad for the initial period.
And then where were they taken?
We don't know.
Do you know where in Baghdad they were initially?
Well, I can't be more specific.
The Iraqi National Security Advisor, they're not very forthcoming, was he? What implications do you think your film is going to have?
Well, I think the Iraqi government now hopefully will be under pressure to answer what happened to these five men. We know that four are already dead. And I think that hopefully it will put pressure on the Iraqi government to do all that it can to secure Peter Moore's release, whom we believe to be alive. And it seems that the possibility is that he will be exchanged for a high-level political prisoner called Qaisar Khazali, who will ultimately form part of the new Iraqi government. So we're moving from the armed militia phase into the new government elections in January, and it is expected that Peter Moore will be released alive. But I think, you know, for the last 2.5 years, the Iraqi government have been saying we're doing all we can, and now this film is actually pointing the finger and asking the question as to what do they have to do with the men's abduction in the first place, and puts the onus of responsibility back on them to try and certainly get Peter Moore out alive.
You can watch the film we've been discussing on the front page of the website at guardian.co.uk. And elsewhere on the Guardian website, the latest from Mallorca after British tourists became stranded following a fatal bomb blast on the Spanish island. That's at guardian.co.uk/world. Keep up with the score at Edgbaston in the Ashes third test at guardian.co.uk/sport. And heard the one about the president, the policeman and the Harvard professor. Details on their White House meeting over beers at guardian.co.uk/America. Next, legal history has been made by the law lords who've ruled that legislation on assisted suicide must be clarified. Debbie Purdy from Bradford, who suffers from multiple sclerosis, argued it's a breach of her human rights not to know if her husband will be prosecuted if he joins her at the Swiss clinic Dignitas should she wish to end her life there. The Director of Public Prosecution says there will be an interim report by the end of September and permanent policy will be published next spring. Debbie Purdy spoke to us shortly after the unanimous decision was made. I asked her what the decision means to her.
It means that I don't have to make a decision because Keir Starmer, the Director of Public Prosecutions, has said that he will come up with an interim policy by September, which is going to be a reasonable, thought-out, you know, decision. And that means my life will be longer.
Well, explain that. How does it make your life longer?
Because without Keir Starmer giving a clearer policy, because I don't know what's going to happen, I would go to Switzerland when I was still able to go under my own steam without any assistance. With Keir Starmer being prepared to clarify his prosecutorial policy, it means that I'm going to be able to ask my husband. Now, I'm not quite sure what I can ask him yet. We're not going to know that until Keir Starmer's policy is published. But, you know, I will be able to ask him for some help.
So what would be the central issue you'd like to see in the guidelines by the DPP?
If the Director of Public Prosecutions can clarify the difference between a malicious encouragement for somebody to end their own life or indeed maliciously putting pressure on somebody to end their life early, or the compassionate support for somebody who has made a decision, who is competent, mentally competent and able to make a decision, somebody like me, somebody who offers help and support that they otherwise wouldn't be able to carry out their wishes.
Can I ask you a complicated question now? And that is, there are problems, aren't there, with guidelines. Unless the law is in fact changed to make assisted suicide legal, it could lead to an unworkable situation for prosecutors. For example, in the case of self-defence, I might want to get clarity in the instance that if I was attacked and believed the only way to save myself was to kill my attacker. Without guidelines, I could argue that that's a breach of my human rights.
The laws, you can use reasonable force. If the Director of Public Prosecutions tells me that I can ask for reasonable help, being that I am physically disabled, you know, because committing suicide isn't illegal. Assisting it is. So what I do is not up for question. My husband supporting me would be, and yet that, I think, is unreasonable. I don't think it would lead to an unworkable situation. And I do think we need the politicians to be prepared to discuss this. I do think we need new law on assisted suicide. But that's not what this legal case was about, and it's not what the law lords have made a decision on. They have only made a decision that I need to know with clarity how much support or help I can ask for to carry out a perfectly legal activity.
A final and brief question for you, Debbie Purdy. Do you hope that there will be a Dignitas-style clinic in the UK?
No. Swiss people don't use the Dignitas clinic. Switzerland is the only country that doesn't have a residential qualification, so they need a clinic. But people in Switzerland who want to use the law on assisted dying will die at home or in hospital. That's what I want in this country.
Debbie Purdy on her legal victory. Still to come, we speak to the man behind what some see as one of the most offensive programmes on television.
Homosexuality is wrong. Just keep it in the bedroom, you know? I mean, I'm not all in your face with my heterosexuality.
This is Guardian Daily. It's been the bloodiest month since the Falklands War for British forces. 57 troops have been wounded in Afghanistan in the first 2 weeks of July, compared to 46 in the whole of June and 24 in May. Back home, former soldiers and supporters of the men on the front line have repeatedly come out to pay their respects when the bodies are repatriated. The residents of Wootton Bassett have seen more than their share of funeral processions in recent weeks. Down the road in Watchfield is the site of further welcome parties. The Guardian's Stephen Morris reports.
A roundabout on a busy A road in Oxfordshire. There's a fast food restaurant, a big pub, a co-op supermarket. Not the most prepossessing of spots, really. But every time that servicemen or women are repatriated from Afghanistan, crowds gather here to pay their respects as the hearses carrying the bodies drive from RAF Lynham in Wiltshire to a hospital in Oxford. Wootton Bassett, 20 miles or so down the road, tends to get all the attention, but along this whole sad route, ex-service personnel, ordinary citizens, young and old, gather to stand and pay their respects.
To the front! Salute!
I'm Ron Locke. I'm the chairman of the Guildford branch, Royal Marines Association.
So you've come quite a long way today.
In total, it's a 157-mile round trip.
So why do you feel so strongly about coming here?
Well, because as a former Royal Marine, you know, we've always been respected the passing of people and the cause for which they gave their lives, and to me that's very important, you know, and... As I always say, if you're out there and you haven't got a lump in your throat or a tear in your eye, then you shouldn't be there. That's the way it should be.
How many people do you get out here?
We started off by having about 15 to 20 Royal Marines in the main, or former Royal Marines, that is. And gradually it's built up, and when we repatriated the eight the other week, then... suddenly, from nowhere, we had about 400 people here.
And it's not just ex-service men and women coming here?
Well, no. A lot of the people we're getting now are civilians who, you know, live locally and come to pay their respects as they do in Wootton Bassett.
What's your name, please?
Verity Turner. I've moved around a lot with the army, and I've worked at the college here. My sister. So it means a lot to us to come here.
Yeah. And I think it's built up here, hasn't it? It started with a few people, now there's several hundred sometimes.
Definitely, yes. Definitely. Yes, it's very nice to see them, actually. It's lovely. Very sad.
It is very sad.
Nice of people to pay their respects.
This isn't meant to be a political gathering, but in the pub afterwards, some of the ex-Marines pass around a poem, apparently written by a serving soldier, that seems to have a pretty clear anti-government message.
There's supposed to be a covenant to treat us fair and square, but I had to buy me army boots and me combats is threadbare. And half the bloody helicopters can't get in the air, and me pistol jammed when snipers fired. That's why I'm laid up here. Yes, it's Tommy this and Tommy that. We have to watch the pence. Bold as brass, the PM says, we spare them no expense. But I'll tell you when they do us proud and pull us out all the stops. It's when Tommy lands in Lynham in a blooming wooden box.
A former British soldier ending that report by Stephen Morris. Finally, we lighten the mood with the man behind Johnny Bravo, American Dad, and Family Guy.
Did anybody see that absolutely fabulous piece on Fiji in yesterday's travel section?
Oh, I wish I was Beyonce.
Peter, I think maybe you should go back and have that doctor undo whatever he did. I mean, you're not gay.
Homosexuality is wrong.
Are you being serious right now?
Just keep it in the bedroom, you know? I mean, I'm not all in your face with my heterosexuality.
No, you are not.
Dad, now that you're gay, I don't have to have sex with you, do I?
Not unless you want to. Oh, Oh, my muffins are ready.
You made muffins?
Well, it wasn't the muffin fairy. Or was it?
Seth MacFarlane is in the UK this weekend to appear at the BBC Proms. He'll be singing show tunes to help celebrate 75 years of MGM film musicals. Our reporter Stuart O'Connor joined Seth over a cheese omelette to talk about this weekend and also his new project, a spin-off from Family Guy, The Cleveland Show. Stuart O'Connor first asked him how he ended up singing at the proms.
The simple answer to that is somebody asked me, and the set list was full of songs that I know and love, and figured what could be more fun than to sing them with a 92-piece orchestra. I think I was a replacement. I think Kevin Spacey was supposed to do what I'm doing, and he had to shoot a movie, so somehow somebody threw my name into the mix, and I couldn't turn it down. On top of the fact that I'm a lover of classic orchestration, yeah, I'm not actually still not quite sure how it happened. I keep meaning to get the full story, but I've been so busy with the actual rehearsing that haven't had time.
Cleveland Show.
Mm-hmm.
So you've already got a whole season in the can.
I mean, not in the can. It's in various stages of production. On the one hand, a Family Guy spinoff seemed like at least something that was worth talking about, but there was also a lot of interest from Mike Henry, who does the voice of Cleveland and does a lot of other voices on the show. He really has his own point of view that's very, very unique. I mean, I've known the guy since college, and he's always just cracked me up. But he approached me with Rich Appel, who at the time was writing for Family Guy. And Rich he's the only writer in television who's written for every Fox primetime animated show. You know, he's one of the best writers / showrunners in Hollywood. And the combination of him and Mike Henry, I mean, you know, those two guys could pretty much write a sitcom about the phone book and it would have a shot. They're just extremely talented guys, and this is something they wanted to pursue, and I thought it was a great idea. Cleveland is an appropriate character to spin off, not just because we're in the Obama era, but he's a more dimensional character than, say, Quagmire.
Hey, I was wondering if you ever thought of giving Quagmire his own show, but I suppose there's limited...
Yeah. Nobody wants to watch a sitcom about a rapist, at least not on a network, maybe on cable.
That's Family Guy creator Seth MacFarlane talking exclusively to The Guardian's Stuart O'Connor. That's it for today's Guardian Daily. Producing today were Adam Gabbett and Harriet Grant. I'm Mike Duram. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.